Hello, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this special podcast from the Army Benevolent Fund to mark Remembrance Day and 80 years since the Allied invasion of Italy during the Second World War in 1943. 80 years ago, in 1943, as the Allies pushed Rommel's Africa Corps back across North Africa, 15th Army Group was formed in Algiers. Its first task, to plan, prepare and deliver Operation Husky, the invasion of Sicily on the 10th of July 1943, the largest amphibious landings of World War II. 15th Army Group was founded around the United States 7th Army, commanded by General Patton, and the British 8th Army, commanded by General Bernard Montgomery. British ranks were decidedly international, as French, Poles, Greeks, New Zealanders, Indians, Canadians, Brazilians, Palestinians, Australians, Free French and Italian non-belligerents, to name but a few, gathered under its wings to play their part as the Allies gained the first foothold on mainland Europe, in the bloodiest of fighting over the demanding Italian terrain, in extremes of weather, battling the formidable well-organised might of the Wehrmacht. No less than 20 Victoria Crosses were awarded in Italy, twice that of Northwest Europe. In this programme, we will discuss three incidents of great bravery, courage and leadership, and discover the many and varied challenges the military faced, and how the hard-won victory was paid for by heavy casualties and significant losses. At 15th Army Group's head, charged with breathing life, shape and form into this leviathan beast of war, was a British general, Harold Alexander, an experienced, civilised and capable former officer in the Irish Guards. Military historian Dr. Peter Caddick Adams.
Of all the commanders in the Second World War, I think he would be my personal favourite. He would be the one I would most like to have met. He was the most easygoing and the most collaborative. And if you look at him and his contemporary Montgomery, who's confrontational, Alex got the most out of his coalition partners. And of course, the thing we have to remember in Italy is there are, what is it, in fighting in Italy, there are 21 different coalition partners. And you really do have to be a diplomatist as well as a commander just to get the best out of those under you. And Alex was that man. And of course, the big speculation is whether if Montgomery had stayed in Italy and Alex had come to Normandy, whether we would have had a more smooth run campaign in Northwest Europe. And I think we would. Because I think he was every bit as good as Monty, but a real gent into the bargain. The Allies settled on Sicily because we, the Brits, realised the Americans were not ready to undertake Normandy. And had they gone too early and got it wrong, you don't get a second shot at invading France. So Sicily was the happy compromise. And the plan that was drawn up was to keep the two main invading forces of Patton's army and Montgomery's army separate. But since therefore Sicily is quite a small objective, and it meant that you assaulted virtually every invasion beach there was all around it. And to do that simultaneously, you had to do that simultaneously because you could alert all the German reserves on the island. So we invade in mid-July 1943. And the campaign is swiftly fought. But if you take a snapshot of the invading force, there are more troops who land on more beaches surrounded by supported by more naval craft in the first few days of Operation Husky, as it was called, than there were for Operation Overlord a year later in 1944. And geographically more ambitious in the first few days. What it does, of course, is it trains the main players in Husky for overlords. That's the that's the end result, which is why Husky is so important. So it's not just that we learn to get the measure of the Germans in the field and the way they might fight, because don't forget, North Africa, there is no population around, really. And you're fighting over vast arid areas of nothing. Sicily and indeed Normandy, you've got a population who've got nowhere to flee to. So your tactics have to be very, very different. And there's urban combat, for example, that you really don't see even in Tunisia. Close air support, there's a bit of that in North Africa, but it makes all the difference in Sicily. I'm not sure that Normandy is scaled down because it's a similar sort of size. The important thing about Sicily is the Allies have several aircraft carriers on standby that are used to fly missions over the island, which are clearly just not applicable for the Channel a year later. So it's slightly different in that respect. But it is very much, I mean, it's a well-fought fight, but it's also a training ground for what will happen in the future. And I think all the senior Allied commanders are very much aware of that. So they want to play their best possible game, because if they mess it up in any way at all, they're going to be excluded from the ultimate prize, which is to be in on the invasion of Europe.
I'd like to drill down from the strategic down to the operational tactical level and talk about the work of the then commanding officer, Special Raiding Squadron, Blair Paddy Maine, whose role was to lead a maritime raid to take out the coastal defence batteries. That enabled 13 Corps under General John Harding on the left wing of 8th Army to make their landing successfully and safely. What is your view on the strategic importance of that raid?
Well, that raid was to open up, if I remember correctly, the port of Syracuse, and the Italian gun batteries were quite formidable, although the troops who manned them eventually folded fairly rapidly, but we couldn't know that at the time. But what this does, of course, exercise is the entire range of special forces, and particularly the close observation pilotage patrols, the cops, the chaps in canoes, who've been measuring the depth of sand and so on, which will allow you to identify which are the suitable invasion beaches on which to land heavy transport, for example, because you know whether there are rocks or whatever underneath, and we see them used again before Normandy. So it's not just the special forces who land as the vanguard of the invasion for Husky. It's actually the a much wider range of special forces. But under Maine, they attacked this gun battery with on the clifftops. And the interesting thing is, if you go there today on the headland, you can still see all the positions, because there's been no reason to remove them in any way at all. The guns have been removed, but nothing else. And you can see just how ferocious assault it was, because you are climbing up cliffs to get to these things. The whole island was on alert, because there was a real concern that the Allies would be coming over from Tunis at some stage or other. But actually, at the time of the invasion, it coincided with a great storm. And so the Italians and Germans were technically on a lower stage of alert. But the Italians fought back. And I mean, the important point to bear in mind is that the best Italian units were better than the worst German units. So they put up a ferocious fight. And that was the case all the way through Sicily and indeed in some cases in Italy, as it had been in North Africa. We tend to dismiss the Italians, and they were not a force that we could afford to write off. I mean, this is one of the first times the SAS are engaged in ground an invasion, because before, if we remember, their role had been really to raid, pop up, raid, dash back. And in Sicily, they're attacking, and they're attacking to stay. And that's a completely different mindset.
Yeah.
And, you know, their job is to open up the beaches and the headlands for the invasion force. And then they're not going anywhere else except to go, carry on and do this ahead of the other invasion troops. And that required a completely different mindset. And they re-rolled magnificently and did exactly a sort of textbook operation of what was required of them.
The task of the Special Raiding Squadron on the 10th of July was to silence the Italian coastal defence batteries to assist the smooth landing operations of General Sir John Harding's 13 Corps on the British flank. The squadron was fearlessly led by the redoubtable Paddy Mayne, a proud Irishman who was an officer in the Ulster Rifles and an early volunteer for the Special Air Service. A giant of a man in both stature and character, who before the war trained as a lawyer and was possessed of seemingly limitless bravery. Major Mayne's courage and leadership during Operation Husky was recognised by the award of a bar, the equivalent of the Distinguished Service Order that he had already been awarded after an earlier SAS raid behind German lines in Wadi Tamut in 1941. He would be awarded two further bars to his DSO for similar selfless acts of gallantry in the years to come, raising questions in the highest echelons of the country as to why he was never awarded the Victoria Cross. Tim Bentinck reads a citation for the first bar to Paddy Mayne's Distinguished Service Order.
Captain, Temporary Major, Blair Mayne, 21st of October 1943. Second DSO awarded as a bar on the ribbon of the first DSO. Citation. Operation Husky, Sicily. On July the 10th and 12th, 1943, Major R.B. Mayne carried out two successful operations, commanding the Special Raiding Squadron. The first, capture and destruction of coastal defence battery on Capo Muro di Porco, the outcome of which was vital to the safe landing of 13 Corps. By nightfall on the 10th of July 1943, the Special Raiding Squadron had captured three additional batteries, 400 prisoners, as well as killing 200 to 300 Italians. The second, the capture and holding of the town of Augusta. The landing was carried out in daylight, a most hazardous combined operation. By the audacity displayed, the Italians were forced from their positions en masse, and most valuable stores and equipment was saved from certain destruction. In both these operations, it was Major Mayne's courage, determination, and superb leadership which proved the key to success. He personally led his men from the landing craft in the face of heavy machine gun fire, and in the case of the Augusta raid, mortar fire. By these actions, he succeeded in forcing his way to ground where it was possible to form up and sum up the enemy's defences.
Historian and author of the illustrated history of the SAS in the Second World War, Joshua Levine.
I think he's a really fascinating person. And that's because there are, you know, there are so many facets to him. I mean, there's so many facets to everybody, but his are so pronounced. He's such a character. And, you know, he's larger than life. He's a huge man, but his personality also is huge. And when he's successful, he's hugely successful. When he's frustrated, he's hugely frustrated. When he's angry, he's hugely angry. And when he's drunk, he's massively drunk. And he's all these things. And so the you talk about July 43, that's the raid on Capo Muro di Porco. And then following that, Augusta. Now, these were raids. These were, you know, the SAS has been formed as a, you know, sabotage unit behind the lines in North Africa. And Stirling, the leader, was taken prisoner in early 43. And so it had to sort of reform. It had to, you know, rejig its idea of what it was. And Mayne essentially was the person who took over, and you had him in charge of the Special Raiding Squadron. Now, you know, some people felt that the organization, after Stirling was captured, the organization was falling apart and you know, the administration was going to pieces. But actually, what Maine did was sort of lead by example. And his example in Sicily was tremendously courageous. And these were remarkable actions.
Military historian Dr. Peter Caddick Adams discusses the wider issues surrounding the Italian campaign.
The Italian campaign is so fascinating because it stretches you in terms of your capabilities. One minute you're doing combat and in a range of theatres. I mean, North Africa was, basically vast areas of arid desert where you were acting as ordinary infantry. By the time you get to Sicily and then Italy, you are mountain troops in a lot of cases. We have to wind the clock back and learn how to handle mules, for example, because we've got no other means of supporting troops up in the mountains. And then once you've sort of swept the Germans or Italians away, you've got to liberate their towns and their cities and their villages, and you've then got to become sort of civilian policemen. So you've got the full range of different capabilities and requirements, which would tax the patience of an archbishop, never mind a guardsman.
Yeah.
And that's where I see the British Army and the the guards doing so well, because you're ranging between all those different requirements, sometimes even in just a 24-hour period. Your incentive to sort of hit the local population because they've been sheltering someone who was trying to kill you hours earlier is tempered by the fact that these are fellow human beings who've just been caught in the middle. And that's what makes the theatre so difficult and challenging. And you are going in the Italian, in the Sicilian and Italian theatres from the scorching hot of an Italian summer, where you've got shortages of water, to midwinter, where you've got people dying of hypothermia up in the hills, and everything in between. And there's no other theatre I know that's got that range of challenges.
You touched on the ground. The ground was particularly punishing, particularly hard ground from the Apennine Mountains that stretched the entire length of the Italian peninsula. How long do you, I mean, but lay over that too at the same time, is the political turmoil that was going on with the Italian population. And in July 1943, after Operation Husky, the Italian government arrested Mussolini, and indeed, in due course, within a matter of weeks, had transferred their allegiances from the Axis to the Allies. How did that affect the nature of the opposition that the Allies faced as they landed in Sicily?
I think when the Allies land in Sicily, we pretty soon divine the fact that politically they are wobbly with their German compatriots, and that the Axis is wobbling so much to the extent that we may be able to entice the Italians out of their agreements and arrangements and alliances with the Germans. So once there is a comprehensive defeat of the occupying forces in Italy, both Italians and Germans, in mid-August 1943, the campaign only having taken a month. There's then a period of sort of delicate negotiation on Sicily with various Italian commanders about an Italian surrender. But that's not enough for the Italians. And they say, well, look, if we're going to pack in, what we like is the protection of being part of the Allied force, and we'd like to fight alongside you. So we'd like to become an Allied partner of the rest of you rather than an ally of the Germans. Now, for the Western Allies led by Eisenhower, there is a problem, because the Italians have been fighting us for, ever since 1940, and have drawn blood and have killed a lot of our friends. And the idea of fighting alongside these guys who've just decided to change sides because it's got too difficult with the Germans it's just a bit too much. So we never actually call them allies. We call them co-belligerents. But under that, there's a bit of political to-ing and fro-ing for the next 3 weeks after Sicily falls in mid-August 1943. When we say to the Italians, right, well, we're going to invade the Italian mainland and we need you to switch sides. And the Italians say, we won't switch sides until we see that you're about to invade. So the timing has to be absolutely nuanced. And on the 9th of September, as the invasion fleet arrives off the Salerno beachhead, and Mark Clark is preparing his Fifth Army, which includes a British corps led by General Richard McCreary, who will one day be the Eighth Army commander, to land. The Italians then announce that they're switching sides. But the Germans have second-guessed them. And the Italians are one step behind. And so what they should have done is issue secret orders to all their forces to empty their armories, to be ready to take up arms against the Germans. And they don't. So when the Italian government arrests Mussolini in Rome, there is a disconnect between that event and the Italian chain of command, who aren't ready and haven't been prepared at the lower levels to take up arms against the Germans.
The Allies believe, as they come in for Operation Lasker, that there's a possibility that this is going to be an unopposed landing. Is that correct?
Yeah, so the Allies are... the troops on the ground aren't told anything in case it all goes wrong. But it's an enormous fillip when you're on a landing craft to realise that you might have an unopposed landing. But of course, it isn't. It isn't going to be unopposed because the Germans have sort of worked out where we might land. They can't do anything about the landing at the bottom against Montgomery because that's in and around the port of Taranto. The Italians welcome them with open arms, and they don't have any troops there, and they can't get any troops there quick enough. But what they can do is defend the Salerno front with troops coming down from Naples and elsewhere, because there are very good highways that feed into the area. And the Salerno area is a natural bowl of lowland, of beaches and land that only stretches sort of 5 or so miles inland, not even that, surrounded by a gentle ring of hills, which the Germans occupy much quicker than the invasion force, which is half British, half American, can do. And thereafter keep the Allies at bay for a couple of weeks. And what sweeps the Germans away eventually is not the superior fighting of the land force, it's naval gunfire support from a fleet assembled offshore. And that's another valuable lesson for Normandy. The Germans react so viciously and with such alarm at the Salerno landings, which they see as being as accessing the major routes running north-south in Italy, and particularly threatening the ports in and around Naples, that they actually deploy a corps, an armoured corps, which they pull out of Russia and send all the way down to Salerno. And that's one reason why Salerno is so viciously contested, because the Germans, you know, at the operational level, and they respond so well at the operational level, manage to deploy enormous numbers of troops in a very, very short time span. To block and then delay, occupy all the sort of vital ground in and around the beachhead. It's a hard fight.
How would you describe the breakout from Salerno and the fighting it involved? Because it was pretty bloody fighting, is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, the fighting... really, I mean, once you get up into the ridge lines and the Germans are being threatened, they've been in the high ground all the time overlooking the battlefield with their machine guns. But once you worm your way up to the heights, which is what the guardsmen do, the range is so short that this isn't popping shots at one another with machine guns or even with rifles. This is bayonet work. And, you know, you are going back to the sort of the traditions of Sevastopol or, you know, the worst of the First World War.
The 3rd Battalion Coastal Guards landed at Salerno on the 8th of September 1943, along with battalions from the Rifle Brigade, Grenadier and Scots Guards, forming part of 201st Guards Motor Brigade, under command of Brigadier Julian Gascoigne. Major Eddie Windsor-Clive, regimental archivist of the Coastal Guards, picks up the story.
The day they arrived, on the 8th, the news came that the Italians had surrendered. And so optimists had a hope that they might have an unopposed landing. Unfortunately, the Germans disarmed the Italians immediately, and it wasn't. The battalion landed on the 9th. On the 10th, they moved forward to Monte Camino airport, discovered it was too close, they had to move back a bit. Heavy counterattacks, 3 company commanders killed or wounded in 3 days. On the 19th, they moved forward through Salerno to the hills just beyond. And at that moment, there was a hill nearby nicknamed the Pimple. And number 2 company was sent to do a night attack. It was successful, and an MC for Michael Howard, the eminent historian, but the loss of an eye for my father. The exercise forced the Germans back. But the hills had to be cleared before any advance.
What was your recollection from your father when he lost his eye? What was his recollections of the fighting and the nature of the German opposition at the time?
As far as the attack was concerned, chaos.
We're not talking about a bunch of amateurs. These guys have been fighting for some time. They knew what they were doing. They were battle-hardened, weren't they?
Yes, but the big difference was they were now in close country rather than desert. They hadn't really had that much experience of this type of warfare.
And the Germans, again, were a highly professional, very well motivated army. Is that fair to say at this point?
Absolutely.
On the 24th of September, the 600-foot Capella Ridge was captured by the Grenadier Guards. Beyond this was a steep, thickly wooded hill marked on the map as Point 270, the Pagliaroli feature. The 3rd Battalion Coastal Guards was ordered to take the position. Due to the ground, it could only be attacked from the valley 500 feet below, up a steep slope with little cover. The commanding officer, Sir Terence Faulkner, was wounded in the recce, and so Major David Forbes took command of the battalion. On the 25th of September, the guardsmen advanced cautiously in single file with numbers 1 and 3 companies leading down a sunken track which winds down the forward slope of Capella Ridge to the foot of Point 270. The company sergeant major of number 1 company was Peter Wright, a yeoman farmer from Mettingham in Suffolk who enlisted in the Coastal Guards in 1936. Was wounded at Tobruk in 1942 when a sergeant. I knew Peter well. Ever polite, always self-effacing, he was a lovely man who I don't believe had a bad bone in his body. Hear him talk on BBC Radio Cambridge in the 1970s as he spoke of the events which followed shortly after 3rd Coldstream came under effective enemy fire from the German positions on Point 270.
We had orders that we were to move early hours the next morning to a position overlooking Hill Point 270, which was a hill held by the Germans. It had been attacked by another battalion. They failed to capture it, but our orders were to attack and capture that hill at all costs. We weighed the situation up from another hill, and the time of the attack was 12 o'clock on a 2-company front, with our company on the right and the other company on the left. Well, we wound our way down through undercover of trees and grapevines into the valley and moved along the bottom of the hill. And then at 12 o'clock we attacked, and all hell let loose then. The Germans opened up with machine guns, mortars and everything. the actual hill in places got a light, and I was behind with the stretcher bearers. I decided to run forward then to see what was happening. The first casualty I came was the company commander. He was splattered from head to foot from a mortar bomb. He then gave me orders to go and see the second in command of the company, who was on with one of the platoons. I found him. He was seriously wounded. He then told me to find the next senior officer, tell him what the situation was. I then rushed back again to where I thought he would be, and I found him, he'd been killed. That left the young officer who joined us the night before. I then looked for him, and I found him, he'd been killed. I then went to see what was happening on the right flank of this hill. And as I was looking for this other platoon to see how they fared, I ran into these German machine gun posts. I ducked down and crawled back. I don't think they see me. And collected some grenades from some of the dead and wounded. Got a chap to give me cover and fire. And I then got sort of up the hill a bit, and they were on the slope. And then I wiped out the first one with the grenades. Then wiped out the second one with grenades and the boy who was giving me cover fire in his rifle. And then the third one, they ran away. And I grabbed a rifle and bayonet and chased them, but they got away. I regrouped the company and made sure that they were in a position in case the Germans counterattacked. I then sent a message back to the commanding officer that we'd captured the hill and were consolidating our position. Two officers killed, two seriously wounded. Would he send an officer to command the company? And he came himself. We then tried to see how many we'd lost, but our main priority then was to get the wounded back. We got most of them back that night, and then it fell dark, so the Germans counterattacked just before dark, but we drove them off. We then accounted for all the wounded, or nearly all of them. We had about two we couldn't account for, but we eventually found them. And then we went ahead burying the 16 NCOs and men that had been killed, and the two officers.
3rd Coldstream took a beating in that September of 1943. 8 officers and 60 men had been killed, and a further 10 officers and 163 men were wounded. 120 of those casualties were suffered during the fierce fighting for Point 270. Peter Wright's war ended with a bout of malaria, which came on almost immediately after the action as the battalion was taken out of the line. He was posted to run the detachment at Chequers, the Prime Minister's country house, and was presented with a Distinguished Conduct Medal for his brave deeds on Point 270 by the King on the 6th of June 1944. But Peter tells the incredible story which resulted in the upgrade of his DCM at the insistence of His Majesty the King. It is quite unique, and I like to think, makes this particular VC the King's personal Victoria Cross.
Then in September 1944, I was informed that I'd been awarded the Victoria Cross and the DCM had been cancelled.
How were you informed?
I was actually informed by Noel Whitcomb of the Daily Mirror. He came in the sergeant's mess and said, "Are you Mr. Peter Wright?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Did you know you'd been awarded the Victoria Cross?" I said, "It can't be me. I've been awarded the DCM." He said, "That's been cancelled, and you've been awarded the Victoria Cross." I then went and contacted the commanding officer, and he said, yes, he knew something about it, and that was quite right. And then a big celebration started. It appeared that the King went out to Italy, was talking to General Alexander, who said that he thought that this man ought to have been awarded a Victoria Cross. And King George VI said, "Well, can't we cancel the DCM and give him the Victoria Cross?" And that's what happened. And I went up to Buckingham Palace again in November and received the Victoria Cross. There was two VCs on the day, Major Jamieson of Norfolk Regiment, myself. That was a unique occasion, of course. My wife was there, and my mother. Well, I wasn't married at the time. I took the DCM with me in its case. No one asked me for it, so I kept it.
Company Sergeant Major Peter Wright, Coldstream Guards. In Italy, on the 25th of September 1943, the 3rd Battalion Coldstream Guards attacked the Pagliaroli feature, a steep wooded hill near Salerno. Before it reached the crest, the right-hand company was held up by heavy Spandau machine gun and mortar fire, and all the officers had become casualties. Company Sergeant Major Wright, seeing that his company was held up, went forward to see what could be done. Finding that there were no officers left, he immediately took charge and crawled forward by himself to see what the opposition was. He returned with the information that three Spandau posts were holding them up. He collected a section and put it into a position where it could give covering fire. Single-handed, he then attacked each post in turn with hand grenades and bayonet and silenced each one. He then led the company onto the crest, but realised that the enemy fire made this position untenable. CSM Wright therefore led them a short way down the hill and up onto the objective from a different direction. Entirely regardless of enemy fire, which was very heavy, CSM Wright then reorganised what was left of the company and placed them into position to consolidate the objective. Soon afterwards, the enemy launched a counter-attack, which was successfully beaten off. Later, with complete disregard of heavy enemy shell fire on the area of company headquarters and the reverse slopes of the hill, and of machine gun fire from the commanding slopes of the left flank of the position, he brought up extra ammunition and distributed it to the company. It is due to this warrant officer's superb disregard of the enemy's fire, his magnificent leadership, and his outstanding heroism throughout the action that his battalion succeeded in capturing and maintaining its hold on this very important objective. Distinguished Conduct Medal awarded by King George VI on the 6th of June 1944. The London Gazette, 7th of September 1944. The King, having been graciously pleased to approve the award of the Victoria Cross to CSM Wright, the award of the Distinguished Conduct Medal for the same acts of gallantry, announced in the London Gazette of the 27th of January 1944, number 36349, is cancelled. VC awarded by H.M. King George VI at Buckingham Palace on the 21st of September 1944.
By early winter, the Allied advance through Italy had passed Naples, and on the approaches to the famed Benedictine monastery of Monte Cassino, was fighting on the Domino Ridge. General Harold Alexander sums up progress in his Christmas message to the troops, broadcast on the 15th of December, 1943.
A year ago, I spent Christmas Day at a place called Marble Arch in the Western Desert. The victory of El Alamein had recently been won. British and American forces had landed successfully on the shores of North Africa. All was going well. But we didn't know then it was only the beginning of a flood of success which was to carry us to the gates of Rome. Since that Christmas Day in the Western Desert, great battles have been fought, and all of them won. Tripoli, the Battle of the Mareth Line, Tunis and Bizerta have fallen with our 248,000 prisoners. Sicily has been stormed and captured. Sardinia and Corsica have been liberated. Italy has laid down her arms, and today we stand before her capital. But this is not the end. A stern and bitter struggle lies ahead of us, and many more battles have to be fought, and with God's grace we shall win them all. And so with high hopes for the future, I end this message of greetings by wishing a happy Christmas to you all.
But this is not the end. A bitter struggle lies ahead of us, General Alexander said, uttering an almost perfect forecast for the hard going that would characterise 1944, the year ahead. As a series of well-prepared defensive lines built by the German army had yet to be broken. By late January, the 1st Battalion of the London Scottish Gordon Highlanders were fighting on the Damiano Ridge under command of the 10th Royal Berkshires. In A Company of the London Scottish, 30-year-old George Mitchell, a construction worker educated at the Farmer Road School in Nathan, was the old soldier of his platoon, serving in platoon headquarters as the 2-inch mortarman. Andy Parsons, curator of the London Scottish Regimental Museum.
Well, it was a huge ask because, of course, before they got to Monte Damiano, they had to cross to Garigliano. And this was late January. The river was in full spate. And, of course, the weather was against them. It was cold, wet and miserable, as all of the foot sloggers would know. Once they got on the north side of the Garigliano, then they were immediately facing the Germans, who'd been dug in for quite some time in their defensive positions, going all the way up the ridge. It's interesting that the particular feature that George Mitchell was killed on wasn't actually one of the London Scottish objectives, but it was part A Company, the London Scottish, were borrowed or detailed to 10th Royal Berkshires, who are also part of the 168 Infantry Brigade. So it was their objective to retake a position on the ridge. A Company was attached and didn't fare particularly well in that they had all of the casualties quite early on. And in fact, after Mitchell's section had taken the fourth of four Spandau positions, the company commander called off the assault, realizing that in daylight then the ground taken would be indefensible. So it was a bit shocking that all of the ground taken was really for naught.
And then they went back up on during the night time. And that's when it all kicked off for George himself. He was a big man, an impressive character.
So he and his older brother David enlisted as volunteers in 1938. They come from quite a impressive service background. His father, Edward, had served with the Royal Scots Fusiliers for something like two decades, a veteran of both the Boer War and the First World War. And in fact, George himself was a Boy Scout. So I think service was really ingrained in the family. And you're absolutely right. And he would, at the age of 32, he would have been a senior citizen in the platoon. So perhaps it's not surprising that when push came to shove, he took a leadership role.
Reading from the citation for George Mitchell's VC, Tim Benton characterised the monumentous events of the night of the 22nd and 23rd of January 1944 as the London Scottish valiantly fought a hard action to clear the enemy from the well-prepared positions up on the ridgelines.
Private George Allen Mitchell, 1st Battalion London Scottish, Gordon Highlanders. London Gazette, 10th of August, 1944. On the night of the 23rd, 24th of January, 1944, a company of the London Scottish was ordered to carry out a local attack on a portion of the main Damiano Ridge. One section was ordered to carry out a right flanking manoeuvre against enemy machine guns. The officer had been killed, and there was no platoon sergeant. Mitchell had been the 2-inch mortar man in company headquarters, but dropped his mortar, picked up a rifle, and augmented the weakened section. Under intense fire, he single-handedly assaulted the machine gun post and silenced it. Coming under enemy fire again, Mitchell realised that prompt action was crucial and led his section in the assault on a second position, killing 6 of the enemy and taking 12 prisoners. Mitchell neutralised a third machine gun post single-handed, and although his ammunition was exhausted, successfully led the assault on a fourth. One of the enemy who had surrendered picked up a rifle and killed Mitchell. Mitchell displayed courage and devotion to duty of the very highest order. His complete disregard of the enemy fire, the fearless way in which he continually exposed himself, and his refusal to accept defeat so inspired his comrades that together they overcame an enemy superior in numbers and helped by all the advantages of the ground. VC awarded posthumously.
An act of great bravery. What is your take on the events which happened immediately after, once they'd taken the position?
the story goes that what was left of the section then was we're in doing a reorg on top of the position, doing what I guess what you and I would be naturally calling the Kazan ammunition states, trying to call up for more water, more ammunition. And unfortunately, one of the soldiers that had surrendered picked up a rifle and shot Mitchell in the head. In the heat of the moment, one could say that's understandable, that enemy soldier had seen all of his mates killed. The red mist came down, but it's clearly a war crime. Our honorary colonel at the time, Colonel Ogilby, described it as a terrible act of cowardice. It's interesting to note that in the official regimental history, it's not actually detailed what happened to that prisoner, but you can guarantee that he's buried somewhere on that feature. He didn't survive.
What's the Victoria Cross, this particular Victoria Cross, mean to the London Scottish? It is one of the three that you have on your great history. You must be very proud of Private George Mitchell.
Certainly are. And it goes further than that because our parent regiment were the Gordon Highlanders. And in fact, the London Scottish in World War II were administered as a battalion of the London Scottish. The Gordon Highlanders. We kept the name, kept the cap badge. All of the headstones have the London Scottish cap badge on it. But we were essentially one of the many battalions of the Gordon Highlanders. So it's also part of the Gordon's mythology now, the Gordon's story of gallantry, as in fact, it was the only Victoria Cross for all of the battalions of the Gordon Highlanders in World War II.
Summing up the Italian campaign, Dr. Peter Carrick-Adams.
Looking back on the Italian campaign 80 years on, what is your summing up of the great bravery and the hard-fought victory that took place in Italy in 1943-44?
If you ask me about the professionalism and skill and personal initiative of the Allied soldier and where is it best expressed, to my mind, that is always in the Italian theatre in the Second World War between 1943, 44 and 45, because they are really up against it. And it's a theatre that has no end. It's completely unrelenting. And you know, once you've taken one hill, there's another and another. And it just goes on and on. And you know, morale must have really slumped. And this is where junior leaders have to step up to the plate to really command. The challenges of command there are worse than anywhere else I can imagine. And, you know, the fact that they deliver and it all ends as it does is just such a tribute to the British Eighth Army.
As you mark Armistice Day at the 11th hour on the 11th day of the 11th month, so we remember, remind, and rejoice. We remember the sacrifice, great deeds, and the often tumultuous struggle of liberty over tyranny, which, quite unnoticed by many, allows us to watch Netflix unhindered, shop in Tesco's on Saturday morning, or queue for a KFC before the last train home at night. The trivia of everyday life we take for granted. We are reminded that war is a bloody undertaking that I would not recommend even a worse enemy to endure. The Italian campaign of World War II, certainly no less so. Major Blair Mayne's courageous leadership of the Special Raiding Squadron and his example to those under his command must have been a key factor, ensuring the Italian coastal defences were not brought to bear, thus saving the lives of thousands of servicemen as they landed on Sicily for the first time in the Allied invasion. But with the Victoria Crosses won by Company Sergeant Major Peter Wright of the Coldstream Guards and Private George Mitchell of the London Scottish, we see leadership and gallantry at their most visceral, as those appointed to lead are dashed away in a hail of machine gun fire, mortar explosions, or artillery rounds. It is then that leadership and bravery entwine, in an almost mother-like act of caring and courage, as someone has to take charge, just as Peter Wright and George Mitchell did, to ensure success, rather than calamity, ruled the day and night, high in the Italian hills. Maine was a lawyer, Wright a farmer, and Mitchell a construction worker. A reminder to the critics and naysayers of our youth and armed forces today, that we look on through a prism set in stone a generation before. It is a pat on the back for the brave men and women who give of themselves to selflessly defend our shores today. It is they who will rally to the bugle call in our time of need, and it is on their shoulders that the future of the nation rests. And finally, we rejoice and give thanks for those who paid the ultimate sacrifice and gave their today for our tomorrow. Their memory not forgotten. They did not die in vain, and their name liveth forevermore. Peter Caddick-Adams, Tim Benting, Joshua Levine, Colonel Simon Vandeleur, Major Eddie Windsor-Clive, Major James Kelly, Lieutenant Colonel Brian Fahey, Lieutenant Colonel David Carter, and Andy Parsons of the London Scottish for their help and contribution to the making of this programme. Lord Lovat's Lament was played by the pipes and drums of the London Scottish Pipe Band. The Ballad of the D-Day Dodgers, set to the tune of Lady Marlene, was written by Harry Pinn and performed by Hamish Imlach. If you enjoy this podcast, would like to learn more about the work of ABF and how we support soldiers, veterans and their families, please visit armybenevolentfund.org. And from me, Harry Bucknell, thank you for listening and farewell.
Well, the D-Day Dodgers out in Italy, always on the vino, always on the spree. 8th Army scroungers and their tanks, we live in Rome among the Yanks. We are the D-Day Dodgers.
Program editors were Kath Mills and Neil Kerr, by Michael Stigliani. This has been a GameCube production for the Army Benevolent. A holiday with pain, the Jerry's.